Good morning, everyone. It is April 3rd, 2025. It's my dog's 14th birthday. So all gifts and cards accepted. Our first order of business for the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee is approval of the minutes. We do have a quorum, by the way, for April 2nd. Madam Chair, would you like to approve those minutes?
I would. Thank you. And just would like to comment. It's good to see members back who have been out ill.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Really glad to see that. But I do move approval of the minutes.
Perfect. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's also my daughter-in-law's birthday. I don't want to fail to say that. All right. Our first bill, we do have a very busy agenda today and tonight, and so we are going to be asking our testifiers to keep their testimony to 2 minutes, and the committee administrator will be keeping time on her cell phone, so please keep that in mind as you come to the testifiers table. Leader Niska, your bill is the first on the agenda. Members, this is the bill that we just held over last time because we didn't have the bill in our possession. We do now. And so I will move House File 2233. And the motion is to have it placed on the general register. Leader Niska, go ahead.
Well, thank you. We heard testimony on this bill and had a discussion earlier, and I urge your support. Appreciate, again, the discussion that we had and Representative Finke's support of this bill, being a co-author on this bill.
Representative Finke, I know you're a co-author on this bill. Would you like to renew the motion to have it moved to the general register?
That is my motion. Thank you, Leader Niska, and let's move it.
All right, perfect. The motion is before us then, that House File 2233 be moved to the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You are on your way. Quickest bill hearing ever. All right. Next on our agenda, what did I just do with my agenda? I'll put it under here. I got it. Is House File 1524, Representative Harder. Is she in the room? There we go. Welcome to the committee, Representative Harder. Good to see you this morning. I believe there is an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that? Let's see. I'll move the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of passage of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Your bill has been amended. Representative Harder, the motion is that House File 1524 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ag Committee. So go ahead with your bill.
That is correct, Madam Chair. And I thank you, Chair Scott and members, for hearing this bill today. So over the past several years, there have been many discussions regarding the nutrients that farmers use to grow their crops, and we know that fertilizer is an essential component to healthy crop production. And so what this bill does is that it provides grants to ag retailers or co-ops to cover the cost and time involved to be a 4R nutrient stewardship certified facility. So you might be asking, well, what are the 4Rs? And the 4Rs are the right source, right rate, right time, and right place. It's a science-based best management practices and applying fertilizer and crop inputs. And I do have a testifier today, I believe is on Zoom to...
Okay. All right.
Testify on behalf of the bill.
And that would be Ashley Runbolt. Are you there, Ashley?
I am. Can you guys hear me okay?
We certainly can.
All right.
Please state your name. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Ashley Runholt. I'm with I'm the executive chair of the legislative committee with MCPR, and then I'm also the agronomy sales manager at Cottonwood Co-op Oil Company down in Cottonwood, Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair, for having me and the rest of the judicial committee. I am here to discuss the 4R amendment. There's a couple of things. Thank you, Mrs. Hart, or Congress Harder, for the introduction on the bill. A couple of key points with this bill that I'd like to point out, above and beyond the need for showing that we're doing the correct thing with nutrient management from a state perspective. One thing that we typically don't do as ag retail and in co-op is we don't typically charge for our additional services. So what that means is if a client comes to me and says, or if we initiate with a client that we want them to be part of doing the correct thing as far as placement and fertilizer application and rates and stuff like that, we don't charge for those services. So this bill would help us cover our cost for staff and time needed to make sure that all of our staff is educated, and then that we can also implement this to the growers as well. So basically what it does is the 4R program is well known in the Lake Erie Basin. That's where it initiated from. And that was to help curb some of the algae blooms that were happening along Lake Erie. So they've had good progress with that, and we're just trying to implement it further west.
Ms. Runhold, if you could wrap up your remarks, that would be great. Thank you.
Do you guys have any additional questions or concerns for me with it?
If you want to stay online for a moment, if we have concerns or questions, we can direct those to you if you're able to stay on for a while.
Yeah. Yep, okay. Absolutely. I can.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, we will move to member questions. Representative Rarick, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm assuming that this is here because of subdivision 5, the data privacy. I'm wondering if the author could speak quickly to what that was or so.
Representative Harder.
Thank you for that question. I will refer to the testifier. The language that was adopted today in regards to data privacy is the same language that was used in the Senate, and so we wanted to keep the two bills consistent. So the testifier who is online can address your question.
Ms. Runholt, are you still there? Yeah, there you are.
I am.
Okay.
So I believe that the language, I'm not 100% sure what got amended today. Do you guys have time to catch me up to speed on that? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Runholt. What we will do instead is we'll move to House Research, and Mr. Hopkins can answer the question. Mr. Hopkins.
So, Madam Chair and Member, the A1 amendment that was adopted adds private data on individuals to the classification as well as non-public data, because grantees under this program could be incorporated as businesses and therefore not be individuals, so the classification is non-public, or they could be not incorporated as businesses and therefore be individuals, so the proper classification would be private data on individuals. So it adds that private data classification. It also adds, notwithstanding section 13.599, that's the generic classification treatment for grant data, and a lot of grantee names and addresses are made public under that section. This bill keeps grantee names and keeps grantee addresses private, keeps certain information private. So it just clarifies that generic 13.599 grant section does not apply. The provisions in the bill are going to apply for data classifications.
Thank you. Chair Rarick, does that help you out?
It does, but who exactly are we expecting to get the grants then?
Because Representative Harder.
The program will be funded through the Minnesota Department of Health, and it's grants to the producers of that. And so what they will do is that they will use best management practices to work with farmers and nutrient management. And that is to make our soil healthier. And it's also another tool that we're looking at to be used by agriculture to help with nitrates in particular. And this is just another tool for farmers to use in the hopes of controlling nitrates.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, serving on the Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee, we've had a lot of problems with NGOs and grants, and so I just am concerned because we should be. We should scrutinize that and look at it carefully, and especially when Mr. Hopkins was saying that now that data is going to be primarily private. I guess if it's an individual, we've always wanted to secure that, but I'm a little concerned, Madam Chair, that this data will now be private and not reviewed, not reviewable by the public, because we are doing grant money.
So. Thank you, Chair Rarick. Any other discussion on the bill? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Rarick, for those comments, because I really have concerns about this as well. You know, if we're giving grants, and my understanding, I was trying to reread the bill here quickly, but when I read it before, it sounded like we're giving, maybe Representative Harder can tell me if I'm misunderstanding it, but I thought it was giving kind of a pot of money to the industry group to then distribute to the individual grantees as well, and then keeping that data private from the public. And I'm very uncomfortable with that. So I appreciate the fact that, you know, you coming from that other point of view of looking at how are we going to get control over misuse of public funds, that you have the same concern. But, yeah, absolutely, I share that. And I'm afraid that, although I think the underlying purpose of the bill is a good one, I just really can't support this. Thank you.
Given the discussion today, I think we're just going to lay the bill over, and I think there are some issues, and I understand in these situations why some people want to have this information be private, but at the same time, I think there's some stuff that could be worked out, and so I appreciate your time here this morning, Representative Harder. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you for your time.
All right. Yes, House File 1524 is laid over. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1893. Representative McDonald, I saw him walk in. There he is. Welcome to the committee, Representative McDonald, or Chair McDonald. It's good to see you this morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and our sincere gratitude in seeing this bill today. I know you're very busy.
Yes. Let's see. House File 1893. The plan here, folks, is to lay this bill over as well. And with that, I will move House File 1893 before us. Representative or Chair McDonald, tell us about your bill, and I understand you have a testifier here, too. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ahead.
Yes, I do. This bill stems from a constituent, a family member in my district from Maple Lake, actually in Representative Rarick's district, whose son went missing at St. John's University 23 years ago. Completely missing, gone, vanished. 23 years later, the family has no information on the investigation. Now, can you imagine your loved one completely gone missing? No homicide case, just missing. And 23 years later, as the family grows old, not one piece of evidence can be shared with the family. Their hearts are broken forever, not even a nugget. And this is there's a loophole, there's a little black hole in the law, we believe, in the missing cases situation. And this bill brings up a statute that will reduce the time that the evidence can be shared from 30 years to 20 years. But even think of it. 20 years, two decades that the family has zero evidence shared from the police sheriff's office, who's investigating and giving them hope to find their loved ones. Not one shred of evidence can be shared. The grandparents are in their 80s. The father is not in good health. The mother has given up hope. So the bill will hopefully give some hope that for future families that are in missing cases issue would have a nugget of hope of either finding their loved one or at least knowing what happened. And that is why this bill is before you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for giving us a hearing. And with that, I do have my testifier who will give a little more information if it's the will of the chair.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. We do have a DE1 that we need to adopt first, and then we will go to your testifier. Representative McDonald, can you tell us a little bit about what the DE1 does?
The DE1 gives a little bit more an opportunity for, in the case of an investigation, that the either private investigator or the attorney or the sheriff's office will still have the ability to deny sharing this information should investigation still be either brought up again or proceeding. And then it gives it just a little bit more in statute the ability to not release that information should they believe any evidence is needed in the case.
Representative McDonald, it looks like it does, after 20 years, give law enforcement the ability to share with someone representing the family some of the information, if I'm understanding the amendment correctly.
Madam Chair, thank you. You said it better than I.
Okay, sounds good. All right. Any discussion on the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE1, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Your bill is before us as amended. Let's move to your testifier, Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have Josh Newville, who's been working with the family for many years and knows this case very well. So, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to him.
Go ahead. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, staff. My name is Joshua Newville. I'm a private attorney, or an attorney in private practice. I represent the family of Joshua Guimon, who, as Representative McDonald said, went missing in 2002 at the age of 20 years old from St. John's University. 23 years later, his case is still classified as nothing other than a missing persons case. There has been no indication as to what happened to Josh, no suspects identified. The case has not been reclassified as a criminal case in any shape or form. And here they sit 23 years later, and the family just doesn't know what happened to their son. So I'm here on behalf of Josh's family, as a concerned citizen, as an advocate for missing families of missing persons. And this bill, I'm proud to say, works with law enforcement, not against. It's not, the goal here isn't exposure. It's helping provide closure for the family. It provides a narrow, humane exception for families of missing persons who've been gone for 20 years or more, so a significant period of time. It doesn't change the rules for every criminal case. And again, I'm talking about the bill as amended. It simply says that after 2 decades, a family of a missing person should have the right to access the case file either directly or through a licensed attorney or investigator who is subject to licensing regulations and could lose their job, their profession, if they don't work with law enforcement as the bill defines. This means, I'm sorry, I'll come back to that portion. So right now, under the current statutory scheme, the investigative files they don't make a distinction about missing persons cases versus normal criminal investigations. So investigative files stay confidential while a case is active, but in missing persons cases, there's often no identified crime, no arrest or charge, or no statute of limitations that would trigger an inactive status. And so what that means is that these sorts of cases may never be formally closed, and the file may never be made public or accessible to the family members, not even after 30 years. So families can be left in the dark forever with no right to review what was or wasn't done in the case. And that's the gap, or the black hole, as Representative McDonald referred to it, that this bill is intended to close, or at least begin to close. The bill doesn't open the case files to the public. It allows a grieving family, through their legal representative, the right to review the investigation under controlled conditions and to do so for one reason, to continue the search for their loved one. It helps them understand what's been done, identify possible investigative gaps, and continue the search with professional help. Again, the goal here is exposure, or is not exposure, it is closure.
Thank you.
Patty Wetterlein, who's, sorry, I'll wrap up with just this.
Please.
Patty Wetterlein, whose son Jacob was abducted in the same area that Josh Guimon disappeared, she supports this bill. In her words, 20 years is an unbelievable amount of time not to have answers. Not having the opportunity to see the file is incredibly difficult and causes further pain. I fully support the amendment as presented.
Thank you, Mr. Newell. I appreciate you being here and advocating on behalf of the family. And same with you, Chair McDonald. It's a heart-wrenching situation none of us can imagine. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we will move to member questions. Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. And as I'm looking at it and hearing about it, it's like, oh, I can't wait to sign on. I do support it, but then I thought about a situation where the next of kin could be a person of interest or even a suspect, and that really concerns me. And the case that came to my mind was the recent missing person case of Madeline Kingsbury in Winona, I believe, who dropped off her kids at daycare and then went missing, and they ultimately found her body. And the husband was charged and I believe convicted. But had that not happened and she had just been missing all those years and he would have remained a person of interest, I'd be really concerned that his attorney would be able to have access to the investigation. And so I'm just wondering if there are any kind of guardrails that we could maybe put on this to prevent something like this happening, because I certainly wholeheartedly agree with you with the situation that you described in Patty Wetterlein case. I totally believe that the families deserve and need that, because there may be something that's just missing that they may be able to provide some insight for, but those other cases concern me.
Representative McDonald, do you want to take that, or do you want to be your testifier?
Yes, Chair Scott and I discussed that very issue as well just last Saturday, and it was a concern to us. That's why we brought the amendment, but I'll let my testifier to expound on that, Madam Chair.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Mueller. The distinction I think that's important between pure missing persons cases and cases that indeed there is an active criminal investigation happening is highlighted by Ms. Kingsbury's case versus Mr. Guimon's case. In Ms. Kingsbury's case, there was active investigation of a potential homicide. There was, and the time frame that elapsed between when she went missing and when her body was found was significantly shorter than what we're dealing with presently. In 23 years, no body has been found, no suspect has ever been named, and there has been no indication that this is a homicide, much less a criminal case. And that, I think, is the important distinction here. And so while I understand and agree that in the event that, you know, a family member was involved, the next of kin was involved in that person's disappearance, that could be concerning. I think the guardrails here are, number one, that law enforcement can reclassify this case as a homicide investigation, for example, if they have credible evidence to support that, and then this bill isn't applicable. If it's purely a missing persons case, meaning that there's no objective indication that it is more likely a homicide than someone who may have just gone missing because they fell in a lake, for example, as they thought with Josh Guimon for a number of years, that would be a different set of circumstances altogether.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I think my concern is in Madeline Kingsbury case, if she had never been found, it could be still considered a missing person case 20 years later. And maybe missing is defined somewhere, because I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that the bill language carves out the concern in a way that satisfies me. And so, again, it might be just a definition of what you mean by missing person, or somehow excluding if there's a, you know, potential suspect that's asking. I would feel much more comfortable with something like that.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I think there is a solution here somewhere that would lead to you signing on to the bill. And so I appreciate the work on this. We are laying the bill over, and I do hope that we can reach some resolution on the matter. Mr. Neumeister, I know you just got here, and I know you wanted to weigh in on this bill. If you could do it very quickly, we're on a tight time schedule, less than 2 minutes if possible.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. I believe in the premise of this bill. I think it's a positive bill. I've worked a lot with some families over the years who are trying to get access. There was a bill introduced last year. I worked with some of those folks about that. Don Gemberling and I have given some suggestions, and as this bill might be looked at a little bit, I want to offer what those, some of those points were. This can either be for the general public or for family members. So let's say a person would go and you ask for the information, an update, particularly with loved ones, what the information shall provide the following data: whether the investigation is currently being actively pursued by the agency, including the identity of the personnel conducting the investigation, whether the agency is waiting for new or additional information in order to proceed, or other data that assists in the public in their understanding of the status of the investigation. Now, this language was from a year ago that was talking about the public, but it can always be narrowed to a family dynamic, because loved ones on these kinds of things want some information. And there are police departments that say nothing. And in order to be sensitive, at least, and this mirrors various laws like Myers, there's some laws in the past have dealt with kids, but in some situations, these dynamics have been expanded to the family. So that's my two cents. Madam Chair, I think there's a way to work this out with both parties. Mm-hmm. And everyone who has an interest. Madam Chair, thank you for the few moments of your time.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you for those that information, Mr. Neumeister. Appreciate that. Members, seeing no other questions, we will lay the bill over.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Madam Chair Liebling, my apologies are not acknowledging you as well, so thank you indeed.
Thank you, Chair McDonald. All right. Next on our agenda, Representative Witte, are you in the room? All right. We have House File 1396. We are recommending that the recommendation is to pass and have this bill placed on the general register. I believe there is an A6 amendment. Representative Witte, welcome to the committee. Shall we address the amendment first?
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I think Representative Feist is going to introduce the amendment.
Perfect. Let's get this amendment out of the way. And Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Witte, for working with me on this language. I think that it reflects a good update to the language to make sure that we are being really clear, avoiding any sort of overly expansive interpretations and unintended consequences. And so briefly to go through it, we worked together to clean up the language around evidence at imminent risk of destruction. The language around a fleeing suspect is now limited to people who law enforcement has probable cause to believe have committed either a crime against persons, such as a domestic violence offense, or a felony and are actively fleeing. And we're continuing to work on that language to see if there's a constitutional way to encompass people who they expect to flee. We weren't able to quite get that language figured out. It deletes a now redundant provision around people escaping a correctional facility. And lastly, it narrows the scenario around missing persons to achieve the goals without creating broader loopholes than intended. And that's the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, Representative Witte, how the language in the amendment compares and contrasts with the legal use of helicopters in law enforcement, similar effect. You're trying to get a view from an aerial perspective on a situation. Is the use of helicopters more tightly regulated or more open than what the impact of this amendment to the bill would have?
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. I believe it's probably less on the helicopter part. But I know working on with this and the ability of where it can go, it was a good opportunity to kind of fix on the language. But it is probably less restrictive from a helicopter.
All right. Thank you. With that, we will take a vote on the A6. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A6 has been adopted. Representative Whitty, go ahead and tell us about your bill, and then I believe we have some testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. I first want to say thank you to Chair Feist, law enforcement, and the ACLU to kind of – we brought three bills together and to clean up the language. House File 1396 is a bill that expands situations for which a law enforcement agency may use an unmanned aerial vehicle without a search warrant to include uses to document evidence that is at imminent risk of destruction, to facilitate searches for fleeing criminal suspect in a safe manner, and to facilitate the active search for a missing person that involves risk of death or bodily harm to a person. So these are another tool that we can utilize for law enforcement to protect and keep our community safe without violating people's rights. So I do have one testifier from the Sheriff's Association.
Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. And thank you, Chair Liebling, Chair Feist, Chair Scott. My name is Scott Habel. I'm the elected sheriff in Renville County. The Sheriff's Association originally sought this bill. It aims to modernize existing law regarding UAV by law enforcement. And this would really align policy with more current public safety needs. So I'll talk about three of the provisions that this bill contemplates. First, the proposed updates include authorization to use UAVs to document evidence where there is imminent risk of destruction. In essence, this provision allows law enforcement to use a drone to document critical information that could be lost before search warrants can be issued. To frame this up, the current statute requires that law enforcement obtain a search warrant to fly a drone, but for 9 exceptions, mostly where circumstances are exigent. We know how important it is to accurately record and document a crime scene. As an example, think about an outdoor crime scene. They can be pretty large, and being able to capture that bird's eye view might be the best way to allow a judge or a jury to later understand what that scene looks like. Now imagine if that crime scene included maybe a pool of blood or some muddy footprints leading in a particular direction. Now imagine that there's a big storm rolling in and it's just starting to sprinkle. There's not likely time to obtain a search warrant. And so that's where 1396 comes in, and 1396, House File 1396, clears that up. Secondly, as you know, UAVs are an incredibly effective way to search in time-sensitive missing person cases. The language in this bill would grant law enforcement explicit permission to use a drone during active missing persons investigations, which would hopefully improve outcomes. And then finally, with regard to training, that one's not addressed in the A6 amendment. However, today, deputies can only conduct training flights over public areas. I use an example that in my county, we have massive cornfields. Occasionally, we're asked to search for lost or missing kids in those cornfields. And unfortunately, there are no cornfields in public areas where we can train, right? So we literally have no way to train for that scenario. So a deputy responds to the lost child, it's his or her first flight over that type of environment. So 1392 fixes that with the permission of the landowner underneath. Finally, it's my understanding, as you may know, this bill has been heard in other committees. There were some testifiers in opposition from the ACLU. Since that time, it's my understanding that conversations have occurred and all of those issues have been worked out, and the A6 amendment reflects that work.
Thank you for being here today, Sheriff. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to? Oh, actually, we have two more signed up. Alicia Granzi and Terry Nelson is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Madam Chair, members, Teresa Nelson for the ACLU of Minnesota. Oh. Ms. Grancy is not going to attend. Okay. And I just want to thank Representative Feist, Representative Whitty, law enforcement, because we did raise concerns in prior committees. Those concerns have been addressed with the A6 language. And I'm happy to answer any questions if necessary. But otherwise, I just wanted to be on record that we are comfortable with the current language.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson, for being here and for your support of the bill and your work on the bill. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, we will move to member questions. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thanks to everybody who worked on this bill. Really impressive in a very short period of time, too, because it did was heard in public safety not too long ago. I just had one question about the amendment language, and I don't know if this needs a definition somewhere or if it's known. In the amendment on line 1.7, it talks about probable cause to believe the person, the suspect, has committed either a crime against persons or a felony, and I'm just curious how crime against persons is being defined.
And that's to House Research?
Yes, please.
Sorry. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, I don't believe there's a specific definition of crime against persons that is in statute. The phrase, though, is used in other places, and it generally refers to some sort of violent crime, assaultive crime. I believe it appears in the use of force statute, and the Supreme Court recently made a ruling last summer deciding whether a crime against a person requires some sort of assaultive behavior, and they concluded that it did.
Representative Waller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that helps. I'm fine. Thank you so much.
Okay. Any other member questions? Representative Curran.
Just really quickly, I want to say, again, thank you, Representative Witte and Representative Feist. I know that when you're using technology in the space of law enforcement, there can be a lot of concerns when we try to balance safety with constitutionality, and I feel like we've gotten to a really good place because I think technology, as we said in the other committee, does help. It does help to keep everyone safer when we can implement technology without putting people in harm's way. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
And before I go to Chair Liebling, you had a comment, Representative Witte.
Chair Mueller, I just wanted what we were discussing it around was like a stalking case, maybe a domestic. Where someone flees and if they come back around so they don't assault the victim. So that's the persons of crime where we're looking.
Thank you for that clarification. Do you want to go last? Okay. Representative Feist.
I don't know that I did have anything else, but just thanks again for working on it. It's just really important. Like as long as you called on me, now I can't help myself. but you know, whenever we're looking at technology advancing, you know, like I said in public safety, I think it's really important that we think not about what is most convenient, because it's really clear that like cool new tracking devices and drones are easier. And better, perhaps, but we need to think about why is it essential to better protect public safety and to really just remember that we are trying to protect our constitutional right to privacy, and I feel like this strikes the right balance, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Liebling.
Thank you, and thank you also to everyone who worked on the bill, and I just have a question about it, more just from my own lack of background. So, Representative Witte, if this becomes law, how is it communicated to police agencies so that, you know, these are pretty specific rules, and I just would like a sense of, you know, we ask a lot, you know, everybody's got to kind of understand all the rules and follow them pretty closely, and I just kind of want a sense of how that is transmitted and how that occurs. Thanks.
Representative Witte, or do you want your testifier to take that? Kind of walk us through the steps if you get a missing person call or whatever it might be.
So that's a great question, Chair Liebling. A lot of times this would be a specialty position that someone would be operating it. And with their training, I would my assumption is that they will be reviewing all these and know where the ways that they can be utilized and under the circumstances. And that's how most, when you get into these new areas, you want to know where the boundaries are. And so I would assume that it will come down to being a part of their training.
Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. So would it be true then that in most police agencies there'd be somebody who would be charged with kind of keeping track of this and deciding when to use these drones and so on? Like, I realize there's a great diversity in police agencies and they're, you know, some are really small, some are much bigger, but.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I was just trying to, I'm sorry, Chair
it's
Scott.
Okay. It's okay.
Good question. There will be someone who will be in charge of the unit, and it varies from department to department how they want to do that. But I would assume that they're not just letting anyone grab the drone. It's an expensive piece of equipment, and sending it up, hoping that it comes back in one piece. So there will be some supervision on who is overseeing it. And then ultimately it comes down to the sheriff or the chief of police that sets the groundworks and the rules for the departments.
Thank you. Chair,
thank you. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the amendment, line 1.6 through 1.8, you've narrowed it to, as Chair Mueller talked about, crimes against a person or a felony. And I'm wondering why did we stop there and not include gross misdemeanor or misdemeanor? Like, why was it at that line?
Representative Witte.
I think as we're going through the scenarios, obviously someone's fleeing from us, that can be a felony. But we're trying to capture the ones that you could have a misdemeanor domestic assault or a stalking case. So I think that's what we're trying to make sure that we didn't miss out on, and be able to utilize that as a way to making sure that someone doesn't circle back and commit a crime.
Chair Eric.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this getting to the constitutionality that Representative Feist was talking about?
Representative Witte?
Yeah, I would say it is.
Okay. And this address.
What's that?
I was going to ask another question.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time hearing you this morning, Chair Eric.
So. I have no voice today.
I've been ill, so I get it. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this the concern that was raised with ACLU over, like, defining this in that one line 1.6 through 1.8? Was this one of their concerns?
Chair Witte, or Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Scott. I'm going to have BCA Superintendent Drew Evans comes up because he was part of the conversation, but we can get into that part.
Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Representative Rarick. My name for the record is Drew Evans. I'm Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. My understanding, Representative Rarick, is that was the concerns from the ACLU, that they were wishing to narrow the scope of a permissible uses due, as I think you've heard them testify about the number of use case scenarios for UAVs being that they're readily available. And so certainly, you know, through this process, you saw the original drafting and where we're at. I'm comfortable, you know, with the language that it would cover the vast majority of the situations we had used, but it's a narrowing to try to address the concerns of the ACLU.
Chair Eric, you good? All right, perfect. Anyone else on the committee wishing to testify? All right, Mr. Neumeister, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've been involved in the drone issue since 2015, trying to get the legislature, and finally we adopted a bill in 2020. This is a good amendment. Again, technology is being used more and more. As you may know, as part of the drone language, there's an annual report done by the BCA, and it's going off the charts that drones are being used more and more. So this is, at least we're trying to get at least some handle how it's being done, and every year it's reported. Myself and other people have dug into, because of the great reporting that's being done, what are they really being used for? And that information, I'm starting to see. There's pros, cons, there can be questions and all that. So I think as we go with technology, you know, a little bit of time, and with the active reporting, and we see things, maybe it can be expanded. But I think it's a good thing, and I just appreciate this committee, both on both sides of the aisle, coming together on a lot of good public policy, like on some privacy and right to know. Thank you very much, subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. All right, Representative Witte, final words.
I just want to say thank you to the committee. This is a tool that law enforcement will be able to use that can hopefully make it safer for law enforcement, make it safer for the suspect, and also our community. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Witte. I renew my motion that House File 1396 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to the GR. Thank you, Representative Witte.
Thank you.
And Sheriff. I will have Vice Chair Hudson come and take the gavel.
House File 3022 is next on our agenda. Chair Scott, once you get situated, would you like to move that House File 3022 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have the bill before us. Chair Scott, please tell us about your bill.
I believe, is this an amendment to it? I believe I've got something else on top here, the MEM.
I was not aware of that, but by all means, go ahead and speak to your amendment. And could I request Jeff Case to come up to the table as well, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This document that Chair Scott is referring to is a memorandum of explanation, which is required by the joint rules to accompany the revisor's bill to explain all the corrections being made in the bill.
Very Perfect. Well. Chair Scott.
Thank you. With that, I will let the testifier tell us about the revisor's bill. It's something we do. Is it every year or every biennium?
Every year.
Every year.
Yeah.
So just usually always technical corrections and that sort of thing. So I'll let the testifier go ahead.
If you haven't already, please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Case. I'm here on behalf of the revisor's office. This is our annual revisor's bill. It makes technical corrections to the laws and statutes of Minnesota. I know this committee's got a lot of work to do, so I'll keep it short and just say that the revisor's bill is carefully reviewed to make sure that the sections in it are technical in nature and not controversial in the legislature. In addition to thorough internal review, we also share the bill with the Office of Senate Counsel Research and Fiscal Analysis and also the House Research Department before its introduction.
Sounds like a lot of fun reading to me.
All right, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will go to member discussion. Representative Feist.
Thank you. I'm looking on page 7. You've inserted a lot of missing commas, and that seems pretty controversial to me, but I'm willing to go along with it. Thank you so much for your important work.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion, Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just also wanted to say that I really appreciate your work and the work of the office, and the revisor's office kind of always works behind the scenes. We don't even often see members of the office at tables in testifying in committee, but everyone just needs to know that we absolutely could do nothing here without them, and they work extremely hard as it gets down to. Obviously, the revisor's bill is a work that starts early and continues, and I'm sure they accumulate the different things over time, but there's just so much going on in that office all the time. As we get to deadlines, as we get to the end of session, they sometimes seem to work around the clock. So I just thought it would be a good moment to express our appreciation for all the hard work that they do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I have to agree and suspect that there's broad bipartisan sentiment that we would not be able to do anything if there weren't much smarter people than us helping us get it done. So thank you very much. Is there any other member discussion? All right, seeing none, Chair Scott, do you have any closing comments on your bill?
No, I just appreciate the member support and reiterate this, just the accolades for the revisor's office and all the work that they do in a very time crunch manner many times. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Scott renews her motion that House File 3022 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Those in favor, motion by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, the motion prevails, and House File 3022 is on its way to the general register.
Thank you. Thank you.
The next bill is also a Chair Scott bill, House File 2456. Chair Scott, would you like to move that House File 2456 be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families, Finance and Policy?
Yes, that is my motion, Mr. Chair.
The bill is before us. Chair Scott, please tell the committee about your bill.
Right. Thank you. This legislation removes the automatic cost of living or adjustment, COLA, for maintenance and child support orders in Minnesota Statute 518A.75. And just so members get an idea, the federal government requires a review at least every 3 years of all maintenance and, well, of child support orders. And so this is, we've been doing the COLA way for many, many decades, and we believe moving to, and that's an every other year thing, we believe this 3 year cycle and a closer look at each family's individual situations is a better approach to right-sizing child support orders. There's a vast amount of research out there that shows that right-sized orders are the ones that get paid. And so with that, that's basically what the bill does, and I have a testifier here from Ramsey County.
Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Trish Skullpammer. I serve as the Director of Child Support Services in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and I appreciate your time today. So as Chair Scott mentioned, there are federal regulations that dictate how the child support program operates, and cost of living adjustment is one way to make sure that orders are adjusted on a routine basis, but it's not the best way to do it, and Minnesota is only one of four states that continue to have this outdated method. We are required to review all orders that where a child is a recipient of MFIP funds every 3 years. And we additionally are required to send out a notice to all parties who have a child support case that they have a right to request a review. And then the child support agencies would do a full review of the order, looking at both parents' income, all of the relevant circumstances, and come up with a recommendation that would go to court for a right-sized order rather than these increases. And the increases can be both harmful in terms of increasing child support in too small of increments for people who have substantial increases in their wages, or increasing it too much for people who don't get raises that correspond with the consumer price index. This is based on. And so just for, you know, one example that we might see is that in, I think it was 2023, the cost of living adjustment on child support orders was 14%. And I don't know anybody that got a cost of living raise that equaled that same number. And so those orders were increased too much. And then the other side of that, you can have very, very low orders, as low as $50 when somebody's unemployed or underemployed. And then that person becomes gainfully employed. And we miss that opportunity to increase that order to the right size.
Thank you. Is there any member of the public or in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Are there any questions for Chair Scott or the testifier? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you very much. And this is not an area that I am super familiar with. So, you know, just trying to understand how this is working. So from what the testifier described, it sounds like this is all pegged to the wages of the person who owes the child support. And maybe I misunderstood, but and currently, apparently, and under the bill. And I'm just wondering, you know, when you said that 1 year it went up 14%, that was too much. The thing is that what concerns me is I'm thinking of it from the point of view of the child, not just the person who, obviously this is a delicate thing because, you know, you only can pay it if you have the money. But the child also needs, and the child needs the money, obviously, to live. So from the point of view of that, are we sufficiently considering the interests of the child by making this change? Because, you know, if the price of eggs goes up to $6, the child still needs to eat the eggs. And, you know, again, we're always in this discussion on child support. We're always trying to balance the interests of both sides of the equation. Anyway, Chair Scott, I'd love to hear what you have to say about this.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll turn it over to my testifier here in a minute. But in Minnesota, child support is now determined on income shares. So the entire family, you know, whether they're living under the same roof or not, all of their income is taken into consideration. But I will let the testifier explain in a little more detail.
Ms. Scopehammer.
Thank you. So yes, child support is based, the child support amount is based on a set of guidelines that includes the income of both parents. In the old days, it was based on only the parent who was going to pay child support. So there's a much more complicated formula that goes into determining how much a parent should pay. It also includes cost of health insurance, cost of child care, how many children are in the family, and then how many children each parent may be supporting separately. So it's a much more complicated formula that makes the cost of living adjustment less relevant because it doesn't take into consideration all of those other things.
Follow up, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that. So I'm understanding then that this, what's happening in this bill is that we're doing a more holistic process that takes all of this into account. So it probably then has a better chance to actually be good for the child. Because, you know, in all of this, I think the most, to me, actually, the most important interest to be considered is the interest of the children. So is that pretty accurate, though, that then I think I understood you to say that this is that goes from that more one-dimensional process to this more holistic process that reflects the way we do it when we set the child support now.
Ms. Scopehammer.
Yes, thank you. Yes, that is accurate. It is a more holistic approach. And as Chair Scott mentioned earlier, when the order is set accurately based on the true circumstances of the parents, we are more likely to receive regular and timely child support payments, which is certainly looking out for the best interest of the child as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Is there any further member discussion? Seeing none, Chair Scott, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a really good bill. It brings us, takes more things into consideration than just an automatic increase. That some families may not be able to, endure financially, or maybe they're making more than what the COLA would require. So I think it's a good balanced bill.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Scott renews her motion that House File 2456 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Children and Families Finance and Policy. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails and House File 2456 is on its way to children and families. The next bill is also a Chair Scott bill, House File 2959. I will move the bill before the committee. We're going to be laying this bill over. Chair Scott, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2959 aims to close a gap in Minnesota's Government Data Practices Act, identified by the Minnesota Supreme Court, by protecting property taxpayers' non-public data from public dissemination in the appeal process of unrelated property. In his concurrence in the Oracle decision, Justice Thiessen urged the legislature to address this gap in privacy law. Current law allows counties to publicize confidential business data without notice through the course of a commercial property tax appeal. If Building A appeals its property tax valuation and uses Building B and Building C as comps, the proprietary commercial real estate data of B and C become public. Such otherwise non-public data includes income and expenses, information for income-producing properties, leases, and rent. The existing system creates a chilling effect on property tax appeals and creates an incentive to appeal to gain access to a competitor's data. Businesses invest significant effort in keeping financial information confidential, and it should not be publicly accessible through an open back door. My testifier today is Guri Samanth, I hope I got that right, as maybe close. And she is with Fredrickson and Byron, and she's here on behalf of BOMA.
Ms. Samanth, identify yourself for the record and go on with your testimony.
Good
Good morning. My name is Gauri Samanth. I'm a property tax attorney and shareholder at the law firm Fredrickson and Byron, and I represent today the interests of BOMA, NIOP, and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which are organizations that represent tens of thousands of property taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. And I'm here testifying in favor on their behalf of House File 2959. This bill clarifies and harmonizes the various statutory provisions relating to non-public data and their interplay with property tax cases. The Minnesota Supreme Court recently recognized in their 2022 decision known as Oracle that these various statutory provisions are in conflict, ambiguous, fragmented, and disjointed. And they said, quote, "It is time for the Minnesota legislature to step up, engage with all of the stakeholders, and devise a more nuanced solution to this conflict," end quote. That's by Justice Thiessen, the former Speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives, in his concurring opinion. So there are two problems that our bill will fix under our current statutory framework. First, under our current laws, the county can unilaterally publicize and disseminate highly confidential and sensitive financial information that is classified as non-public of property taxpayers without the property taxpayer's knowledge, consent, opportunity to intervene, or object. And when they do that, it's put into the public domain in an openly public property tax trial, and it is available for competitors to take advantage of that information and create disastrous consequences to the business interests of property owners in Minnesota. Our bill will fix this problem to prevent the public disclosure of non-public data when that data is used by any party in a property tax case. So it will not restrict the county from their ability to use the information, but it will prevent it from public disclosure. Second, under our current laws, the county has vastly superior and unrestricted access to use and introduce relevant non-public market data as compared to their opposing litigant in a property tax matter, who is the property taxpayer. Our bill will also fix this lopsided problem and level the playing field in property tax cases so that both litigants, the counties and property taxpayers, have equal access to this highly relevant and critical market data. And this will ultimately result in more uniform, fair, equal assessments of properties, as the tax court will have the ability to consider all market data, not just the data that the county selectively picks and puts into the record. So I can walk through the current legislative framework and how it creates these problems.
I'll need you to wrap up as quick as you can.
There's one additional fix that we have included in our bill, and that is, in Minnesota, if you own an income-producing property, meaning that if your property generates a rental income stream, which is essentially all commercial properties in Minnesota, you must, as a requirement under the law, produce this confidential information to the county. Otherwise, your property tax case will be dismissed. And so that includes lease information, income information, and other specified forms of financial information. If you don't do it by that deadline, you can't proceed on the merits of your property tax matter. This bill also adds a very short 30-day cure period so that if there's an inadvertent error or a technical issue, the property taxpayer can still remedy that and their case won't get thrown out on that technicality. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next on the testifier docket, I have Lane Thor. Mr. Thor, once you're situated, identify yourself for the record and offer us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, my name is Lane Thor, and I did submit a written testimony that I stand on. I'm here today to answer any questions that you guys might have, and I'm here to support House File 2959, specifically the changes to 27805 Subdivision 6, as Ms. Garant just elaborated. So I want to give my time here to answer any questions that this committee might have.
We very much appreciate you making your expertise available. Next on the list, I have Dan Rogan. State your name for the record, please, and give us your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Rogan. I'm an assistant county administrator for resident services in Hennepin County. The Hennepin County is opposed to House File 2959. We believe it's a solution in search of a significant problem, and the solution proposed will exacerbate the concern the bill purports to seek to address. The two statutes at issue, the Assessor's Data Statute and the Data Practices Act and the Tax Trial Statute, have both been in existence in substantially the same form since 1981. The protections afforded to commercial real estate data have remained largely unchanged for 46 years and we believe work well. This matter is particularly important to counties because this bill will dramatically increase assessors' costs and has the potential to impact their ability to use data from all sources to ensure that assessments are fair and accurate. The bill does primarily two things which we think are detrimental. First, in Section 2, it guts the privacy protection of assessor data found in the Data Practices Act. Under current law, a person may obtain income property assessment data, really third-party data, from a county through discovery only if that person demonstrates the disclosure is warranted under the Act's two-part balancing test by showing that the data is discoverable under the rules of evidence and civil procedure, and that really includes looking at it's relevant and it's proportional to what's needed, and if so, that the benefit to the party seeking access to the data outweighs the harm to the confidentiality interests. Under the proposal, this balancing provision is completely eliminated. Any petitioner can request any and all income property assessment data from any property, and assessors are required to provide it. There's no role for the court in determining relevance, proportionality, or the benefit that it doesn't outweigh the third-party interest. This creates several significant problems. While the legislation creates a mandatory protective order that purports to limit the use of this data, in Hennepin County, we had 1,900 petitions filed last year. We're on track to exceed that. That means there will be likely thousands of requests for this third-party data and disclosure to parties and their attorneys every year. There's significant risk that this data will be misused despite these mandatory protective orders. Also, assessors' offices will be inundated with requests for this data. They will essentially be clearing houses for this data. Producing this data for anyone that seeks it will have significant costs. The second significant issue that we have with it is it potentially limits how assessors can use income data through the use of protective orders. Assessors will be forced to negotiate protective orders in every single case. Petitioners will have an opportunity to limit the use of data they provide to assessors to just the case at issue. This will create inequity because assessors will be privy to knowledge that they cannot use to set a uniform and accurate value on all commercial properties. It's unfair and really unfeasible to have different sets of protections for every property case that comes before the court. This is exactly why Section 13.51 exists, to provide uniform protections, having protective orders issued instead of lesser or more inconsistent protections. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on the list is Josh Hoagland. Once you're seated, state your name for the record and offer us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Josh Hoagland. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. I'm really just here on behalf of assessors and the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers to answer any questions you may have from an assessor perspective.
Very well. Is there any member of the public that would wish to testify? Seeing none, we will move on to member discussion. Any questions on this bill? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if the testifier on my right could respond to some of the concerns that have been laid out.
Absolutely. Ms. Smott.
Thank you very much. So I want to be clear, the information that we're speaking about, the non-public data, it's income and expense statements, lease information, other specified forms of financial information of property taxpayers that they're required to provide to the county. And it gets classified as non-public data under the statutes, meaning that it's not accessible to anyone other than the subject of the data. There's two exceptions under our current legislative framework. One is the assessor's records provision, and the other is the balancing test provision. Under the assessor's records provision, the counties and county assessors are free to use non-public data of any taxpayer and make it into a public record. There's no restrictions on that. This bill will add protections for those taxpayers so that their information does not get disseminated into a public forum and can result in irreparable harm to those property owners. We're adding protections, not taking them away. The second is that under the balancing test, there are significant barriers for a property taxpayer to obtain this information from the county, but those same barriers don't exist for the county to use the information. So we have an unlevel playing field. The county can introduce this information to support the assessed value of a property at trial, but the taxpayer who is trying to assert that their property is overassessed doesn't have access to that same form of information. That's how we have a discrepancy in the the market data that is being presented to the Minnesota Tax Court. This bill is aimed to put both litigants that appear before the tax court on equal footing. Both of them should have the ability to access this information in the county's files, present the evidence to the court, and the court can determine which data it wants to rely on, which will ultimately result in more uniform, equal, and fair assessments of properties. Thank you.
Thank you for that response. I imagine one or more of the other testifiers may have additional thoughts.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it's my understanding that assessors are not allowed to make that data public in any forum other than the courtroom, and in that case, the judicial process is what makes it public. But there is no other avenue for assessors to share non-public data with anybody, even the in many cases, the people that give it to us, because it's so restrictive under 13.51.
All right. With that, we will return to member discussion. Are there any questions for the testifiers or Chair Scott? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious for our assessor expert what your thoughts are around this framework and if there is perhaps a more narrowly tailored approach that could achieve the objectives.
Mr. Hoagland.
Mr. Chair. Representative, assessors do, in my opinion, a very, very good job of maintaining this data as private and non-public outside of the courtroom, and the court rules are really what put us in that position. And I think it's really a balancing of maintaining the data as non-public and then the transparency of the judicial process and the tax court process. From my perspective, the data is extremely important, particularly in a market right now like we're having with office towers. There's not a lot of good sales data. Income and expense data is the primary information that we use to try to set that equitable assessment for those types of properties. And without it, we become much more conservative, and it ultimately is going to result in a shift to other properties, including residential.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's happening in those circumstances, as you can imagine, trying to get tenants is you know, job one for these tower owners. And what is happening is some of the the folks are challenging their own, they're challenging the tax assessment purely so they can go to court and get access to that information, for which the folks like my testifier on the left have. And so then they can undercut their competition. That's what we're trying to protect here. And I think maybe this isn't the perfect solution, but I think there is a solution that all parties can come to. And so I just want to state what is happening out there in the marketplace in a practical sense, so that members have an idea of the actual how this is playing out.
Any follow-up, Representative Feist? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, and thank you for grappling with this issue. I just, and I'm glad the bill's being laid over because it does seem like it's kind of not ready to go forward, but I'm just wondering, there's a letter in our packets from the Minnesota Chamber and BOMA and NIOP, and it's not signed. So first of all, I'm just wondering, the letter that I have does not have a signature on it, so I'm a little curious about that. So that would be my first question.
Chair Scott, I'm not sure you have the answer to that or not, but
grab my packets here. There is no signature, so I don't know what happened there.
I apologize if it's not signed. I didn't author it. It appears that this was authored by the respective organizations that I'm here testifying on behalf of. And I know with it being spring break and various travels, I apologize that it was probably just an oversight. We did submit a bill last year in response to the Supreme Court decision. It was a completely different bill. It was to prevent either the taxpayers or the counties from using non-public data, period. And the counties were opposed to that. So this bill is supposed to be a compromise solution. Last year, there was also a letter that was submitted submitted by these organizations, and it was signed. So I think it was just an oversight.
Yeah, Mr.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And believe me, I'm not. I didn't raise the issue to criticize somebody. I didn't think you were trying to hide anything or anything. I just wanted to point that out because I did just want to make a little bit of an unrelated point. And I mean, I appreciate the work. I appreciate this is a serious issue. You know, further work needs to be done. There's no question about it. But and I personally today would not certainly not be comfortable passing the bill. But I hear that there's an issue that needs to be worked on. But I did just want to make sort of a comment. I've heard a couple of times, I heard from you in your testimony and in this letter, when you talk about Justice Thiessen, you make note that he's the former Speaker of the House. I just want to say, I think that's irrelevant to what we do here. And that's why I wondered who actually wrote this letter. But you did say it in your testimony, too. And I just, for my part, I think he's a justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. And we don't do that with other justices, who they were, what they did before. I think it's irrelevant. And I hope that people, I've heard it from you. I've heard it from other people, too. So I don't mean to just single you out. But I just wanted to sort of state that generally because it's on my mind today that we should move off of that. And if we want to talk about what individual justices said, then talk about what they said. Thank you.
Further member discussion. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering how many times this has happened in the last year. I've actually taken something all the way to tax court to expose what was private data. How many times has this happened in the last year?
Ms. Samant.
I've been involved in a trial recently where there were a number of leases and income and expense statements that were introduced and made into a public record by the county. And the subjects of that data were not notified, didn't have an opportunity to intervene or anything like that. So it happens in trial. It's not just trials. There's also in every property tax proceeding, if the case evolves to a stage where you're exchanging expert reports with each other, when you exchange your expert report, when the county prepares an expert report, the appraisal of the property, that same third-party non-public data underlying, so the income and expense statement, the lease statements, and all of those things is put into a work file by the county appraiser or assessor and is exchanged with the opposing party's litigant. So the opposing litigant also gets access to all of that information in that sense. It's not in a public property tax trial, but it is in the possession of another property taxpayer. So we're trying to put some parameters around how this information gets disseminated.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so it sounds like one that you know of. I'm just wondering, Chair Scott, do you know, like, how often does this happen?
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how often it happens, but it's happening.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Further member discussion? All right, seeing none, Chair Scott, closing comments on your bill.
No, I just look forward to working with all the stakeholders to try to find a solution here. So, thanks.
Thank you, Chair Scott. We are laying the bill over, and our next bill on the agenda is also a Chair Scott bill, 2300, House File 2300. I will move the bill before us, and we will be laying over this bill as well. This looks like it's going to be a vehicle bill for our omnibus. Chair Scott, comments on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is the judiciary branch's fiscal and technical change ask. Bill. So I will just let the testifier walk folks through it and then we can discuss it further.
State your name for the record, please, and offer your testimony.
Chair, my name is Dawn Torgerson. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. Thank you for letting us be here this morning. I want to thank Chairs Liebling and Scott for authoring our bill. As Chair Scott indicated, we are here to present on House File 2300, which is our biennial budget and then policy bill. Overall, the biennial budget request for the branch, and everyone did get a separate handout as well in the materials, just in case you want to follow along with that. But our biennial budget request is $112 million, which is an increase of 12.1% over our fiscal year 26-27 starting biennial budget. The budget is broken down into various components. A big chunk of that is for our maintaining core operations. So $77.3 million in the fiscal year 26-27 will be used to increase judicial officer salaries by 6% in each year, to create an employee compensation pool increase of 6% in each fiscal year, to fund the employer share of anticipated health care costs, and also to cover the increased cost of lease space at the Minnesota Judicial Center. And then we have various other items in the budgetary side, $5.1 million in fiscal year 26 and 27, and $1.8 million in 28 and 29 to meet some federal digital accessibility requirements. $4 million in 26 and 27, and $800,000 in fiscal years 28 and 29. This is to improve electronic data sharing with local and state partners, justice partners. $7.2 million in fiscal year 26 and 27 to increase pay for forensic psychological examiners. These are folks under contract. Presently, they're paid $136 per hour. We're asking to increase that to $175 per hour. We're also asking for $18.5 million in fiscal year 26 and 27 to raise the juror per diem. Current per diem for jurors is $20 per day. We're asking to increase that to $100 per day. We're also asking to raise the juror mileage reimbursement. Right now, they're paid 54 cents per mile. We'd like to increase that to the IRS rate, which is 67 cents per mile. We're asking for $3.5 million in 28 and 29 to permanently fund the branch's cybersecurity program. And then the last item is for $14.8 million in fiscal years 28 and 29 to address long-term deficits in our psychological services, our court interpreter services, and then in our jury programs. In addition to the budget request, we do have three small policy items in the bill. These are largely to react to statutory updates and then improve processes for staff, judges, and court users. In sections 1 and 2 of the bill, we address some outdated statute that relates to paper filings that have to be filed at the courthouse where the case is actually venued in St. Louis County. So St. Louis County has three separate courthouses. What this bill will do is allow those who have court filings in the county to file them in any of the three courthouses. They don't have to physically file where the case is going to be heard. Section 3 eliminates the two-page limit on Appendix A notices. This is in child support, spousal maintenance, custody and parenting time orders. This change is just to allow us to better comply with updated legal and digital accessibility requirements. And then the last, Section 4, is really just a small fix. This is to align our conservator statute with the guardian statute. The current statute requires conservators, or guardians, excuse me, to file a notice to those subject to that they filed their annual report. This doesn't happen on the conservator side, and we want to make sure that that occurs there as well. So that's it.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any member of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Any questions for Chair Rarick or her testifier? Seeing none. Do you have any closing comments, Chair Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just appreciate the courts, as always, when they come before us, and appreciate them doing hard work to get their budget proposal in line for us in a very timely way this year. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the bill is laid over, and Chair Scott and I will be switching.
All right, the next bill on the agenda has House File 2412, Representative Hudson. The motion is to lay this bill over as well. So I will move it before the committee. Go ahead, Rep. Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2412 would provide access to Minnesota Court Records online system for private attorneys. Currently, private attorneys face barriers in accessing court records that government attorneys do not. And this would level the playing field by allowing those private counsel the same electronic access, ensuring fair legal proceedings
in Minnesota. There are other states that do this. I believe they are Wisconsin, Colorado, and Florida. And, of course, our federal government as well has a system in place for access to their court records on their level for private attorneys. With that, I will turn it over to my testifier to provide more information.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Hannah Martin, and I am the legislative chair for MACDL, which is the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We are a membership that is made up of private criminal defense attorneys. I'm here on behalf of MACDL to show support for House File 2412, which grants private attorneys equal access to court records within the Minnesota Court Information System for any case in district court. Right now, judges, their staff, prosecutors, and public defenders all have easy access to court records for all cases, including pending cases, simply by searching a person by their name in the court database. As a private attorney, we have less access to that information. We need a court file number in order to look up a pending case. If we don't have that court file number, this often requires us to drive to a courthouse, go through security, and look up a client's name in the court database to get access to that information. There are many examples in private attorneys' day-to-day lives where this barrier hinders our ability to represent our clients adequately. But I will provide just one example that I see frequently. We have individuals or their families that will call in to hire us after someone has been arrested. And in that moment, we have no ability to look up that person by name to determine what they're charged with or what the allegations are against them. Then the following day, we'll appear in court for a bail hearing after they've been arrested. And everybody working in that courtroom will have more information about what's going on with my client than I do. There have been moments where I will walk up to a podium as my client's case has been called. A court staff member will hand me the criminal complaint, and the entire courtroom will sit quietly as I read through this three-page document to figure out what's going on with my client's case, and then immediately proceed to represent them in their bail hearing. In that moment, I am not as prepared as I should be as their attorney. It creates inequity amongst defendants and makes an already backlogged system that much less efficient. I'm here on behalf of MACDL, but I know that all private attorneys who are in court would benefit from equal access to court records and this information. A well-functioning and efficient court records system fosters a more equitable legal community for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify in this bill? Very good. We will move to member questions. Members? Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Hudson. I just had one question, and I don't know where these rules are, how they pertain to public lawyers, but I know when I'm using these systems, I can only use them for the cases that I'm actually working on. I can't just go take a look-see at something else. And I don't know if that's an internal thing or if that's somewhere else in statute. So the situation that you describe makes total sense to me. Either you're looking at a client or potential client, but are there any guardrails in place for attorneys to just start looking up any and all cases or names if they want to? Thank you.
All right, to the testifier, if you want to answer that.
Thank you. So there would not be any guardrails in place. However, as an attorney or as a general person of the public, anyone can go to the courthouse and look up anybody's name and have access to all of the records within their case. Those records themselves are all considered public information. It's just about how you access them. So for any member of the public, they would have access to that if they are willing to go to the courthouse and look it up. For us, it's simply removing that step. It's about the inefficiency of private attorneys having to jump through hoops to get information that public defender, prosecutors, and judges can get simply by having access to the database.
Chair Mueller? Okay. Any other member questions? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for carrying this bill. So my question to the testifier is, you know, the courts have made a request for funding, and in the bill we just heard that Chair Scott is carrying, I happen to have it in front of me here. They're asking for $4 million over the next biennium and this is the words in their bill, is to improve systems, processes, and procedures necessary to provide access to court information for justice partners. And then they're asking for ongoing funding of $400,000 for the next biennium. But so my question to you is, I don't know if you're familiar with their request. I'd like to know, has there been any discussion between your organization and the courts about exactly what it is they want to do? I'm really interested in knowing if this proposal would meet the needs that you're bringing forward.
Ms. Martin?
I don't have access to that information. We have not had those conversations amongst our organization. I know as an organization, we're looking for equal court access into courthouses as well. Private attorneys not having to go through security, which has been a lot of conversation about the funding behind that. We have not had those conversations.
Okay. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this is not about that access to courthouses. And unfortunately, that's a whole different discussion. And one that I have sympathy for as well. But this one, so I know the bill language is always, you know, not always that precise about what the money's for. And obviously the courts are an independent branch. We don't dictate to them exactly what to do. But, you know, my understanding of this, although the bill doesn't say it, is that this is to help private attorneys, at least in part, is to help private attorneys be able to access these records because they have to do some technological build out in order to do that. So I think, and if I don't know if the court administrator is still in the room.
I think they all left.
Well, anyway, I just want to put it out there that, you know, I'm hoping that what we're seeing here in this proposal is going to address the needs that you're bringing forward. And that's why I was really glad to see Representative Hudson carrying the bill, because it is something that I would like to see happen, and hoping that we're going to be able to help fund it, and that if we do fund it, that it actually will address this issue. So even though you don't have the answer here today, I guess I would just ask you in the this is all going to happen pretty quickly, but, you know, as we get to end of session, when these things get finalized, I hope that MACDL can try to have those conversations to make sure that what they are asking for the funding for is actually going to help address your needs, or if there's any input you need to have to, you know, any discussions that need to take place, now is the time. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Liebling, for those insightful statements. So, you know, we all know that making assumptions in legislating is a bad idea, but I guess when I looked at this language, my assumption was there is that existing Minnesota court information system. I don't know how much money would be required to simply add accounts to that system so that attorneys could be able to access them, but to the degree that this would require some sort of cost, there is a provision in lines 114 and 115 that the judicial branch may impose a fee that is for them to determine for requests for documents and information. And my assumption would be that that fee would be set in such a manner to be able to keep this thing self-sustaining. And again, assumptions, right?
So. Yeah. Thank you, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that too, because That is part of this. I'm glad to see that in this bill because it shows the willingness of attorneys or the attorney organization to do that. And indeed, that might be, given we're in a very tight fiscal situation, as you know, and this is, they also need the ongoing funding, that might be a solution to be able to have this be sustainable over time. But I think the build out, what I understand from their budget request is that they need to do some kind of technological build out to make it possible in the first instance. So thank you.
Thank you. Closing remarks, Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is, I think, pretty evident a measure to provide equal access to folks who are on the defendant side of cases in our state. And I know that there's broad bipartisan sentiment that we ought to have fairness of access to resources in order for people to be able to properly defend themselves. And so I'm hoping there will be support ongoing for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hudson, for bringing the bill. The House File 2412 is laid over. The committee will recess until the call of the chair, which will be approximately 15 minutes after the close of session this afternoon. With that, the committee's in recess. I'll call the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee back to order. Y'all are a lively bunch for this late in the day. The first bill on the agenda this evening, we have a quorum, by the way. I guess we don't have to announce that second time, do we? The first bill on the agenda this evening is House File 2825. Representative Hudson, would you like to move House File 2825 be passed and placed on the general register?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All righty. With that, the bill is before us. I don't believe there are any amendments. No. So go ahead and speak to your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Liebling. I'll start out by saying that today marks my high score for bill presentations in one day. And that is due to the grace of both chairs. I particularly want to call out Chair Liebling for, first of all, having the foresight to recognize that this does indeed impact data practices and therefore requires a hearing in judiciary, and then having the grace to allow us to slip it in at the last minute for consideration today. So what House File 2825 does is it would allow expunged records to be accessed as part of a background check on a person seeking to be a licensed as a private detective or to provide private security services. And this is something that would align our vetting of potential employees of security agencies and private detective agencies to have the same sort of scrutiny that is currently provided to our other public safety officers who, when they go through their background checks. So what they're looking for, as my testifier will expound upon, is they're looking for past convictions that would disqualify someone from being able to be licensed as one of these private security officers or a private detective. And that currently is something that they are to some degree obstructed from doing by virtue of our continued practice of increasing the number of expungements. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Mr. Hodgson, go ahead and state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Richard Hodgson, H-O-D-S-D-O-N. I am here today wearing my hat as the as a public member of the board that licenses private detectives and private security officers in Minnesota. I am the board chair as well and the longest serving member of the board. As Representative Hudson indicated, we are not looking to expand or reduce or restrict or any way who is eligible to be licensed. The legislature has already established that certain criminal convictions make someone ineligible to be licensed. For example, assault, gun crimes, felony theft. You probably don't want those people guarding your property. What the legislature did in the expungement statute, Chapter 609A.03, said that certain convictions should be made available, for example, for law enforcement employment. We don't want felons working as police officers. And what was missed years ago when that statute was enacted is our board was left out of that exclusion. This would allow our board, when someone applies for a license to work in this industry, to protect your persons, your property, your children, public venues, for us to make sure that they are not have a history where it's been proven beyond reasonable doubt that they committed these crimes. And so we're simply trying to be able to find those individuals to make sure we do what the legislature has already told us to do, is to make sure we have the right people protecting our property. And I think I have submitted, and yesterday I did submit more extensive material. I hope the committee is, I know we're playing catch up here, and I appreciate that. I hope you've been able to get it. I certainly can respond to any procedural or substantive questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one else, we'll move to member questions. Members, do you have questions on this bill? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here this evening to talk about this important issue. So What are the, I think, Mr. Hodson, you mentioned that you want to make sure that people who have certain convictions are can be screened out of employment. And could you be a little more specific? I mean, what is it that you're looking for that you would want to be screening out here?
Mr. Hodson.
Thank you, Representative. That's already been established by statute. We're not asking to change that at all. And the statute that already tells us who must be screened out is found in Minnesota Statute 326.3381, Subdivision 3, parentheses A. And it lists the criminal convictions, for example, felonies, gun crimes, receiving stolen property. So they're listed in the statute, Representative. If that helps give you some guidance.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. You know, I know I have this letter in front of me, but honestly, I haven't had a chance to read it, or as you said, you distributed. We brought the bill came late, and we, you know, we made an effort to get it in, and so on, kind of getting in right under the wire here. So we haven't had a chance to really look at it the way we might like to, but so do you has this is. I think been, I don't know when we passed the exception for the police officers for criminal justice agency. I think it was somewhat recent, but has there been a problem here? I'm just wondering, what is the real problem that you're solving?
Yes.
Mr. Hodson.
Thank you. The legislation that expanded the scope of expungement was passed in the 2014 legislative session, was effective January 1st, 2015. And even at that time, there was an exception for criminal justice employment. Where things are changing is the scope of expungement. The policy decision has been made to expand the scope of expungement first effective January 1st, 2015, and now effective January 1st, 2025, with the so-called automatic expungement or Clean Slate Act expungement. That's happened. Okay, we accept that. But what we have seen already is individuals who have applied for licenses. And this, the two case, we've already had at least two cases where they've applied for licenses. They also applied for expungement at the same time. We were, the process of the court, but they had to go through the court process for that. Mm-hmm. So by the time they got around to the court process, we'd already been able to run the record checks. So we already knew that by state statute, we should not have issued them a license. Our concern is, as people now figure out the proper sequence, first they go in, get the record becomes sealed. A sealing of the record, according to the Minnesota Supreme Court, doesn't undo the conviction. So we're in a bind. We're not supposed to legally issue a license, and yet we might accidentally do that. This is to try and prevent that from happening.
Chair Legley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm really struggling with this bill is that when we do expunge, and I hope some of my colleagues who know more about this than I do will maybe speak to it here and, on both sides, but when we expunge records, my understanding is the very point of that is because there's been a decision that either the nature of it or the time that's gone by are such that a person should not be barred from certain things that they would be barred from if they didn't have the expungement. And so I'm kind of wrestling with, I know we made an exception for criminal justice agencies, and I think what you're sort of suggesting here by being here is that this is kind of akin to being in a criminal justice agency, but I'm not really sure that that's true. I mean, you're asking for, the bill is for, this is for security. Well, maybe I could just ask you, who would be covered under this bill?
Mr. Hodson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the statute that we are contemplating would cover licensing, individuals who are licensed to perform that function. And in order in Minnesota to legally be a protective agent, work for a protective agent company or a private detective, you must have a license, meaning you're vetted, you're trained, and properly credentialed. So this would apply to those entities. But the state statute that I cited to you also says that if you work for those individuals, that you also must pass the background check. We don't license individual security officers and private detectives in Minnesota. We put the burden on the company to do the vetting. And in many ways, that's the same way we handle it for licensed peace officers. The Post Board, for example, when someone applies for a license to be a peace officer, and I don't want to give you too long of a history lesson. I was the Post Board's first lawyer for 8 years, going way back to 1978, 1979. You wouldn't know that by my youthful appearance, but I was. We have the police department and the sheriff's office do the criminal history record checks, the backgrounds, and then they convey that information to the Post Board and say, this person hasn't passed the background investigation. They've got an assault conviction, a theft conviction, whatever. And so that's the similar model we're using right now. We have the burden on the license holder to make sure that the people meet the requirements of statute. And that saves taxpayers money because that means that they do that. They pay a fee. This is a revenue bill neutral bill. I want to make sure that everybody knows that as well. In this day and age, it's public safety on the cheap. But we do think that it is valuable that way. And to your point, Representative, that expungement doesn't actually, under Minnesota statute, and I'm not going to turn this to an expungement class because I teach that for thousands of cops, but what it does is seal the record to help employment except for professions, we don't think it should, for housing especially, these types of issues. But some of the professions, like law enforcement, employment, like teaching, like running daycare centers, this body has decided, our legislature has decided, our public policymakers decided, if you're going to, for example, run a daycare center, you shouldn't be a child abuser who's been convicted. And again, I want to emphasize, our proposal is like law enforcement, and it's actually more restrictive. We're only talking about convictions. If someone has been arrested and gotten diversion, or gotten a stay of adjudication that didn't result in a conviction, we don't. We're not dealing with those people. These are people where it has been, after a trial or a guilty plea, it's been determined by a judge and a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that they committed an offense, which are disqualifying offenses. If a check were to be run and they come back with a conviction that isn't a disqualifying offense, that will not fall within our board's purview. That will not change anything if this bill is enacted.
Chair Lieberman?
I think that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any other members have questions? Sounds to me like you're just sort of being put on par with other law enforcement officers, but with some special exceptions that you're kind of limiting yourself to. Is that a good synopsis?
Madam Chair, that's a very good summary. There are as many security officers in the state of Minnesota now as there are licensed peace officers. And as we run out of, as we have a shortage, as many of you are aware, we have a shortage of licensed peace officers. More and more companies are saying, we need to keep our consumers safe, our customers safe, so let's make sure that we have some kind of security. So private security, private detectives are filling that gap more and more.
Right. Got it. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative for your bill. I just wanted to follow up on one of the questions that Chair Liebling had. You said that there's a statutory list of disqualifying, and is it, you'll have to forgive me, I know very little about being a private detective. but is it like if you have one of these, you are automatically disqualified, or is it like, okay, well, maybe there's a circumstance, or is there, because that to me is kind of like when I think about the expungements, you know, and the work that I used to do where there was some expungement work, and, you know, I just would like to get a better sense of like, yeah, it's like kind of like you have been convicted in the past of any of these things, you're disqualified. Is that accurate?
Mr. Hodgson.
Representative, that is essentially accurate. There are always release. If, for example, if you went and if you really wanted to be a private detective or private security or run a company, you would have remedies. You could, for example, go to the Pardon and Commutation Board under Chapter 638. You recall in the last couple legislative sessions, their authority has been much more expanded. So if I really wanted to be a the next Philip Marlowe, I would go to the board, and I had a disqualifying conviction, for example, a gun charge. And now my life is different. I don't carry guns illegally. I don't threaten people anymore like I did in my checkered past. I would go to the pardons board, make my case. If I got it, that would be an avenue by which then I could get back into the industry. And we do have individuals. We have one long-term licensed private detective, for example, who did exactly that. He had a federal conviction that was a disqualifier. President shows you how long ago it's been. President Jimmy Carter pardoned him, and he has been a 40-year-plus private detective and security company. So it is there are avenues available. We just want to make sure that they get the avenue the legal way. And right now, we're worried that it wouldn't happen that way.
Chris, I think you follow up.
President Carter was very kind. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? All right. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hudson, thank you for the bill. Mr. Hudson, what if I was to apply for this license and I was approved, what special privileges do I have now that I didn't have when I was just a civilian?
Mr. Hudson.
If you are a licensed, well, it would depend if you're applying for a licensed private detective, a private detective license or a private security license, because those are different licenses. If you wanted to be a licensed private detective and apply, you had the requisite training, et cetera, that would give you access, for example, to databases that no one else has access to. You could now run record checks through the Department of Public Safety. You would give you access to that kind of private data that non-licensed individuals don't have. It means you could earn money doing investigations without committing any crime. You have to have – it's a gross misdemeanor to do investigations without having a proper license. If you were going to be a private security company, likewise, again, you would be able to work in events. You would be able to drive armored trucks with – firearms and haul money to banks and do those kinds of typical security functions that you could not lawfully do without a license.
Representative Frazier.
So, and thank you for that. That was helpful. So if and I understand the legal point you're making about the law being expunged is different than a pardon, but it's still the same activity, expunged or pardon. What changes? I mean, it's really just a legal distinction that the pardon says that the crime has been the incident has been forgiven, and the expungement just says the incident has been sealed. Is that correct?
Mr. Hodgson.
Thank you. That largely is dependent on the legislature. The legislature has decided that for some purposes, a pardon or an expungement has the effect of setting aside a disqualification. For other purposes, it does not. For example, with the post board, if a person gets an expungement or even a pardon, the post board, by rule, which has the force and effect of law, like a statute, says that still does not restore their ability to become a police officer. We have a whole statute, Chapter 364 of the statutes. It's called the Ex-Offender Rehabilitation Act, which was enacted way back in 1975. And it generally says for professional licenses, for many public professional licenses, the fact that a person has got a criminal record or been arrested can, unless it's directly job related, cannot be used against them. But going all the way back to 1975, the legislature said there are certain professions that are so safety sensitive that those protections don't apply. And the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agent Services has from day one, the legislature going all the way back to 1975 said, because of the public safety aspect of that, like for law enforcement, those we are going to put into this more reserved, higher standard of conduct category. So as I said, this is not at all a new concept. If we go back to 1975, that's even before I started practicing law. So that's a really long time.
Any other member questions?
Can I follow up?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
No, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dodson. So I guess the question for my clarification, in this application process, if an individual was applying for private detective or protective agent licensing, is there a difference if I've been pardoned versus an expungement? Is there a difference in terms of how you look at that application?
Yes, as I indicated, we have an individual who has been a long-standing licensee who got a pardon.
Yeah.
So there are mechanisms. A pardon is absolutely different than an expungement. The Minnesota Supreme Court has ruled on two occasions that a sealing of a conviction does not have the same effect that a pardon does.
Yeah.
That case is State versus MDT and State versus – I can't believe I'm just about to do this. I'm sorry. I'm acting like I'm talking to a bunch of judges. I'm sorry. But there are – trust me, there are Supreme Court cases that do make that distinction, and I can certainly share that with you. Actually, I think they're in our written material.
Representative Frazier?
Thank you. No, and I don't mind. I'm an attorney, so I don't mind speaking that way. And I guess that's my point, is that in these particular situations, the board would look at this and say, if it's a pardon, regardless of if the situations are the convictions are similar, if it's a pardon, we will move ahead and grant the license potentially. But if it's an expungement and we look at that record and we have access to those expungements, if it's the same crime and you have not been pardoned, we would reject that license.
Mr. Hodgson.
That's correct. The pardon does have a far stronger set-aside effect than simply sealing a record.
Another question? Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Just final comment. I think that's what I'm struggling with, is that there doesn't seem to be the type of the public policy decision to allow for expungements was to allow for people to move forward. Same with pardons. And I think there is some conflict there in terms of how we treat individuals with having a pardon versus having expungement, and particularly where there may be the same instance that led to those particular incidents that they may have been convicted of. And I'll leave it there, but that's what I'm struggling with there.
Thanks, Representative Frazier. Representative Liebling, did you have another comment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I think and maybe where Representative Frazier is kind of going, I'm a little bit struggling with too, because the real question here for us is, if we allow the expungement to be opened for purposes of this, then the real question is, should people who have an expungement of an offense that would otherwise disqualify them, should they not be able to get these jobs? Are they somehow not safe or not capable or something of doing these jobs such that we should open up the expungement that they've been given? I wish I understood more about expungements, because frankly, I don't really have that background, and we don't really have time to do that now. But I really think for us as policymakers, that's really the issue, because as I think you've been saying, Mr. Hodgson, it's really a matter of law how these things get treated, and that's what we're here to do. That's what we're here to decide. And on what basis do we decide? I think it's for us to decide whether in this context, an expungement should mean that record stays sealed, which means that these people get the job or not based on other things. And I just don't feel like I understand enough here today to say that we should allow that expungement to be opened. I appreciate the bill being brought. I appreciate thinking about the issue. But personally, I'm just really not ready to, just because this is so quick, I don't have the background for it. I just don't feel I can support this today. So thank you.
Representative Hudson, a word, and then we'll go to Representative Ingen.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chairs. So I very much appreciate the conversation that this bill has generated, and I will note that it's gotten far more scrutiny here in judiciary than it did in public safety, which is a testament to the detail-oriented nature of our members. What I'll say is, and I'm going to try to offer this in as unbiased a manner as possible, when we consider the legislative intent of existing law, obviously the intention of the statute that Mr. Hodgson is referencing was that folks who have received a conviction for certain crimes should not be entrusted with these licenses or working for somebody who holds these licenses. And I think the rationale for that is very similar to the rationale for allowing law enforcement agencies to do a criminal background check to find out if somebody, and to open expungement records to find out if somebody's had certain convictions. And the reason for that is we balance in public policy the concern of safety against the concern of access. We do it all the time. People have rights to access certain areas and to do certain things, but we curtail that when there is an overriding safety concern. And in particular, when we're talking about, because again, I understand the intent of expungement. I understand where Representative Frazier and Chair Liebling are coming from, that the intention of expungement is to offer somebody a second chance to move on with their life. The question becomes, is that just an open door to do anything? And we've already decided, as a past legislatures have decided, that it is not an open door to become a peace officer. And I would argue or speculate that the rationale behind that is because when you become a peace officer, you're endowed with a tremendous amount of trust and authority that you wouldn't otherwise have. And that is a responsibility that needs to be wielded by someone who has a high degree of character and trustworthiness. Now, as a private security officer, doesn't have the same authority as a law enforcement officer, but they do have a tremendous amount of access. And I say this as someone who worked for much of my young adulthood in this industry, the private security industry, in various venues, various roles, supervisor, manager, armed and unarmed, all different types of environments. You have access to everything. Like, the folks who protect us here have key cards that can get them in the places that we can't, yeah. Right? You have access to every place. You're encountering the public, you're encountering personnel and staff, and you're endowed with this protective trust. That properly should merit a higher level of scrutiny regarding your character and your ability to be entrusted with that responsibility. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think of situations like there are private security guards at hospitals.
Yes.
Higher. Maybe there's a private security guard outside of a women's shelter, and we want to make sure that those people don't have a, as you said, checkered past, you know, and it's up to the private company to decide. Am I right, Mr. Hodgson? So if a hospital is looking to hire private security guards, I guess they're probably hired through a private company to supply that, but the hospital would want to make sure that if there was an expunged record that it wasn't for a violent behavior or maybe drug addiction. These people have access to medications, for instance.
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. That is what, if you hire someone to guard your chicken coop, you hope they're not a fox.
Right. Thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually object to Representative Liebling's assertion that because she doesn't know that much about expungement, that therefore we should just not give this a shot to pass. Because here's some of the, actually on the AG's website, the list of stays of adjudication that would be eligible for expungement. Giving a pistol to an ineligible person, a pistol without a permit, a transfer of a pistol to a minor, counterfeit, cell phone hacking, interfering with a bus driver, computer fraud, mortgage fraud, false certification of a notary, wildfire arson, general arson. These are all really, those are pretty serious crimes. And just because you receive a stay of adjudication does not mean that you should be entrusted with securing or ensuring the safety of people at a hospital or a domestic violence center, like Chair Scott had mentioned. So just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
I think, members, we're going to go to a vote. And all those in favor, Representative has some final words, and then we'll go to a vote.
Sure, I'll try to keep it brief. We've discussed this for a long time, but while I appreciate the point that Representative Ingen is making, I'll just point out that stays of adjudication, as I understand it, are not something that would flag somebody from not being able to get a license. So we're talking about convictions here. It's a high standard. I think it's reasonable, and I would appreciate member support.
Representative Liebling has asked for a roll call, so the CLA will take the roll call.
Chair Scott?
Aye.
Chair Liebling?
No.
Vice Chair Hodgson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Representative Bliss?
Aye.
Representative Corinne?
No.
Representative Duran?
Aye.
Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Finke? Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Moeller? Representative Rarick?
Aye.
Representative Steer?
Aye.
Representative Moeller?
I know. There being seven ayes and six nays, but it takes eight votes to get a bill out of committee, the motion is not adopted. I guess Representative Hudson, when a bill fails in that fashion, it's laid over. So I move. So I move that House File 2825 be laid over. Is Representative Abadji, I think I saw her earlier. There she is. House File 1862 is before us. The motion is that it be laid over. Chair Liebling, would you like to move House File 1862?
Yes, that would be my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. House File 1862 is before us. Let's check for amendments here. I don't think there are any. I don't see any amendments. So, Representative Abadji, if you would like to go ahead and present your bill, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to present House File 1862, which is a technical bill to clarify language so that the Office of Appellate Counsel in Training can complete its setup and begin its mission. So as background, in the last session, House File 922 was passed and became a law to establish the Office of Appellate Counsel in Training with the goal of providing attorneys for parents who are seeking an appeal on cases related to their children and child protective services. The attorneys from that office could be used in state cases, ICWA cases, and in tribal court. The office also has the responsibility of training attorneys for these types of cases and who practice at both the district and the appellate court level. This office will help support counties who may not be able to provide appellate attorneys as required by the state law that requires an attorney for indigent parents, parents who are in poverty, in child protection cases. Advocates had sought this office for many years, and the timing of the office also matched the start of the requirement that parents had a right to counsel in cases concerning their children. Yet after all the advocacy and the passage of House File 922 last biennium, the office has been unable to begin its work because of some administrative issues that require a legislative fix. And so one of these issues, which is what this bill brings forward, 1862, is that it addresses the lack of clarity around which branch of government would administer the office. The law was clear on how to appoint the board, which they have done, but it was not clear on the administrative functions like hiring an executive director and other staff. And that's why the office has not yet launched. So the language before you today was developed by advocates, the Office of Management and Budget, and a board member to ensure that the office could start effectively. The bill clarifies that the office will be part of the executive branch, designates the governor to appoint the initial chair from the members of the board, allows for the hiring of staff, and sets the compensation level for attorneys and staff. This bill does not require new costs since the funding for the office was already allocated and is ready to be used once this administrative clarity is implemented. I believe I do have one testifier joining remotely, so if she's online, we can turn it to her and then stand for questions. Thank you.
Ms. Woolman, I think, is with us, and please limit your testimony to 2 minutes if you can. We've been at this all day, so.
Nice to see you, Chair Scott. Thank you so much for your willingness to hear this bill. I don't have much to add other than what Representative Abadji said. I will mention a couple additional things. A lot of work has gone into creating this office. Our justice partners, the judiciary, the Guardian Ad Litem's office, the county attorneys and others support the establishment of this office. Parent representation in Minnesota is inequitable across the state. People who have a child removed in a more rural county have a really different set of resources and access to attorneys than those who live in the metro area. And so one of the things this office hopes to do is to be able to help provide a more equitable distribution of attorneys on appeals in Minnesota. And it's a very short turnaround. An appeal in a child protection matter from a permanent order is 20 days. I also would point out that with the recent passing of MIFPA and the African American Family Preservation Act, these two laws require comprehensive understanding of new practice and statutory provisions, and this office will be a true partner and help in ensuring that attorneys in Minnesota are able to fully actualize the promises of those two critical laws. As part of this office, will also be charged with training. This office has been in the works for a very long time. We worked to get a fix, and I'm so grateful to be able to testify today. I'm happy to answer any more specific questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wollman. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, member questions. All right, well,
okay.
Home run, Representative Abbagi. With that, any final words?
I just want to say thank the committee again for your time. Appreciate your consideration for this bill in the future policy package. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Liebling renews her motion that House File 1862 be laid over. And it is. Representative Curran, House File 1373 is before us. Representative Curran, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. I move that House File 1373 be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right, the bill is before us. Go ahead with your presenting your bill, Representative Curran.
Thank you again. Thanks so much, Chair Scott and Liebling. Civil legal services, or legal aid as it's often known, provides critical legal representation to low-income Minnesotans in civil matters. A recent cost-benefit analysis shows that civil legal services delivers $4 back to Minnesotans for every dollar that's invested. That means more Minnesotans with secure housing, recouped payments, equitable outcomes in family court, and more. This is on top of the benefits our court system feels when parties are represented in court. But right now, one out of every two of our constituents who are eligible for these services and walks into their local legal aid office is turned away due to a lack of capacity. This denies Minnesotans access to justice, deprives them of financial security, and bogs down our courts. This bill continues the investments we made last biennium and allows more of our neighbors to access the justice they deserve. From there, I'll turn it over to our testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony, and please try to keep it to 2 minutes.
Yes, excuse me. Thank you, Chair Scott, members of the committee. My name is Bridget Gernander. I am currently the staff attorney for the Legal Services Advisory Committee that will be transitioning to the State Board of Civil Legal Aid effective July 1st. We also have on Zoom testifier Dori Rappaport, who is providing the provider perspective, whereas I have a few statements about the administrative side of things. If we also have slides in your materials. Would you like me to start or Ms. Rappaport?
Well, let's go with our testifier that's online. And Ms. Rappaport, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony, that would be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us this evening. Again, I'm Dori Rappaport. I'm the Executive Director of Justice North. Civil Legal Services is a statewide system of programs delivering critical legal assistance to low-income Minnesotans. Today, I was told about a case where a legal aid staff attorney had to file an immediate action to protect children who were exposed to both violence and illegal drug use in the care of one of their parents. This action quickly removed the children to the safe care of their other parents. Normally, an action like this can take significant time, especially if the parent is unrepresented. But because this parent had a legal aid attorney, they were able to get their young children to safety in a much shorter time frame. Civil Legal Services is just one leg of the three-legged stool of the Minnesota justice system. As you can see in your handout, the other legs of the stool are the courts and the public defender. When all three legs are balanced, we can ensure that the justice system works for all Minnesotans regardless of their income. Victims of crime, veterans, senior citizens, and many other vulnerable populations would have no choice but to represent themselves in this justice system if not for Civil Legal Services. I'll now turn it back over to Bridget Jernander to talk about state funds management.
Thank you, Ms. Rappaport. Ms. Gernander, if you want to go ahead with your testimony now, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Scott, members of the committee. So this is a transition year where we are moving from the Legal Services Advisory Committee that has been in place since 1982 to an independent judicial branch small agency called the State Board of Civil Legal Aid. So my job has been preparing for that transition. Primarily, our focus will continue to be on administration of grant funds and ensuring that they are efficiently and effectively administered, and as well as the work that, as all grant managers do in the state of Minnesota, to ensure that they're spent in line with the statute. So that is happening as of July 1st. On the next slide in your packet, another thing that my office does is collect statewide data about the services that are provided. So that includes financial data as well as case data. We have some information about the financial data that's collected through our office. This is a representation of all of the grantees when their total budgets are added together to show the portion that comes from the state appropriation, and then the other work that's done by all of the nonprofit organizations to try to maximize these funds. But that is the role that our office plays and that we will continue to play with the State Board of Civil Legal Aid.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing no one, member questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here this evening. I just really would, can you just give us a little bit more about the transition that you've gone through and kind of what is the, because I wasn't here in this committee and involved in that, and I just want to understand kind of what's the improvement, if you think there's an improvement that we get from the current way that it's going to be set up.
To the testifier, Ms. Gernander.
Thank you, Chair Scott, Representative Liebling. I think that the main change that's happening is that, having been part of the court system, I've been in this role for 17 years now, the courts have worked diligently to manage these funds, but it is obviously one of a multitude of things that the court system is taking on. In light of all of the Office of Legislative Auditor reports and other reports about the importance of focused grant management, I think the most important part of this transition is that there will be 100% focus on these funds and their impact on civil legal aid. Also looking at effectiveness, but the statute provides an additional a new component that is looking at the quality of the services provided, which we have not taken on before, as well as the effectiveness of the dollars themselves. So it really is a more comprehensive support of civil legal aid statewide.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing none. Representative Curran, any closing statements?
I'll just say thank you again, chairs and members, for your consideration. I appreciate it.
Seeing no more discussion, the bill is laid over.
The next bill is House File 1039. I will move the bill before us. Members, we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Chair Scott, I see that you also have a A1 amendment. Would you like us to adopt the amendment?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I do have the A1.
Would you like to describe it all before we ask for discussion, or is it relatively simple?
I can explain to you what the amendment does. This amendment is based on feedback from the board. And with the initial drafted date on January 15th, we were made aware that the data would be approximately a year old at that time. So changing the reporting date to July 15th would allow the report to include the most recent grant information along with the case closed data for the prior calendar year, since the grant contracts follow the state fiscal year. It also changes the reporting from once every 2 years to every year.
Is there any
member support?
Is there any member discussion on the A1 amendment? Representative Curran. Oh, okay. Very well. Seeing no further discussion on the A1 amendment, all those in favor of adopting it signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Scott, now that the bill is in the shape you prefer, go ahead and speak to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, well, let me back up a little bit here. Since the establishment of the Legal Services Advisory Committee in 2012, the court has required a written annual report on the work of the committee, including revenue received and grants made to civil legal services programs. Effective July 1st, 2025, the grant making that has been done through the Legal Services Advisory Committee will transition to the State Board of Civil Legal Aid. The State Board of Civil Legal Aid will be a new judicial branch agency independent from the administrative control of the court system, similar to the State Board of Public Defense and the Guardian Ad Litem Boards. This bill emphasizes the importance of a smooth transition to the new State Board of Civil Legal and promotes ongoing transparency, accountability, and effective resource allocation for Minnesota's civil legal aid programs. So what we're doing is just the report that was done before, we're just asking them to do the same report under the new makeup of the Board of Civil Legal Aid.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Is there anyone present who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. I believe Representative Curran had a comment.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Scott. And as the author of the bill last biennium who created the board, I appreciate you bringing this and just wanted to put on the record that I have zero concerns and I signed on to this. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, I'll turn to Chair Scott for closing comments.
It's continuing the board's practice of transparency and accountability, and I hope that members will support it.
Seeing no further discussion, the bill is laid over, and we'll move on.
Chair Liebling, you have House File 3070 before us, and I do understand that your testifier is with us via Zoom. So the motion would be, did she say, oh, good? I will move House File 3070 before us, and members, this bill also will be laid over. Chair Liebling, tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and this is the bill for the Competency Attainment Board. It is their bill, and I am not really I'm not really the person who should be presenting it or discussing it. We just, I threw the short straw to drop the bill so that we could get it before us and have the board in to talk to us as we're figuring out what to do with the budget and so on, and
perfect.
I think there's some policy changes as well. So
perfect.
I would just ask the testifier to let us know about the bill.
All right, very good. Ms. Larson, Kim Larson, are you with us? There she is.
I am, yes, Madam Chair. Hello.
Hello, Kim. Thanks for joining us this late in the day. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony about the bill.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kim Larson. I'm the State Program Administrator for the Minnesota Competency Attainment Board. And thank you to Representative Liebling for drawing the short straw for us. A little bit about the board. We were created in 2022 as an independent board within the judicial branch. So just as you heard, similar to the Board of Public Defense, Guardian Ad Litem Board, and now soon to be the Board of Civil Legal Aid. The statute establishes a forensic navigator program, and forensic navigators are appointed by the court in criminal cases where there are questions about the defendant's competency to stand trial. Forensic navigators are impartial participants in these cases, and they're charged with helping defendants attain stability and competency so that they can resolve their case. They do this by connecting defendants with services such as housing, mental health and substance use treatment, and other supports based on each individual defendant's needs. Defendants that forensic navigators work with receive services from a variety of programs, some of our defendants are eligible for competency attainment services through, for example, DCT's AMRTC program, which is a locked hospital level care facility. But the majority of the defendants that our forensic navigators work with are residing in the community or are still in custody. You have two handouts, I believe, in your packet from us, one that discusses the bill and one that's an agency overview. Our bill has two parts to it. The first part are policy changes that were approved by the board for submission, and then the second part is an appropriation that matches what we originally submitted several months ago. The policy sections of the bill cover a couple of things that I'll go over quickly. So the first and most space-taking up change that we're looking for is shifting the term currently in the statute that is supervision and changing that to monitor. And the purpose of that is to clarify that forensic navigators don't have the same supervision role or authority as other agencies such as probation and pretrial services. The second policy change is just eliminating a data collection duplication, which would change the statute to allow us to obtain reporting data that's already collected by the State Court Administrator's Office and use that data in our mandatory annual report to the legislature and partners. Our program would still collect and report to the legislature on forensic navigator specific data, so such as how many were assigned to cases. And then the third policy change is just eliminating the requirement for board membership to include a former forensic navigator. And then, like I mentioned, the appropriation portion of the bill really just reflects an increase in funding to support our continued growth so that we can fully meet the needs statewide and support the board's core operations. As indicated earlier, the amounts that you see in there were aligned with our original budget request that was submitted prior to the February forecast and budget targets. The board and the Forensic Navigator Program, I'm really happy to report, crossed the one-year anniversary just earlier this week. April 1st, 2025 was 1 year past our initial effective date. And in the last year, we've made a lot of positive progress, but we still have room to grow, and there still are needs that we need to be able to expand to meet statewide. Your support of our bill would mean that we can continue to mature the organization to become what was envisioned by the 2022 legislation and consistently meet the needs of the courts and defendants statewide. and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Thanks for joining us in that good overview. I do have a question for you. When we met with you a few weeks ago, I think you were saying that you thought that you were going to be making offers or onboarding 7 forensic navigators, and I'm just wondering how that turned out.
Yes, I'm happy to say that we currently have 24 forensic navigators employed, and as of next Wednesday, we will have 30. So we will be adding 6 additional forensic navigators to our complement, and that will put us at 30 total.
Thank you for answering that question. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we can move to member questions. Seeing none, Chair Liebling, do you have any final comments?
No, just appreciate the board, and that it's good to hear that progress is being made in onboarding folks, and and that's it. Thank you for hearing it.
Sounds good. All right, members, without House File 3070 is laid over. We have no further business before the committee. You are free to leave. We're adjourned.